radical left has taken over the Democratic Party.
Hello and welcome to Think Progressively, covering politics and all the other chaos life has to offer. This is episode 114, recorded on Friday, February 16th from Milwaukee. I'm Joe.
And I'm Jason.
And on today's episode, we discuss the history behind the Freedom Summer Project of 1964. But first, the headlines.
Up yours, woke moralists. We'll see who cancels who.
First up in headlines today, Joe, we're going to talk about a shocking story that has come out. An unsealed indictment from the FBI on Thursday shows that informant, whistleblower, GOP star witness in the Hunter Biden corruption case, Alexander Smirnov, has been charged with lying about Joe and Hunter Biden taking millions in bribes from Burisma.
No, you don't say.
And obviously, if you want more information about this, we had a whole episode about it, episode 93. We went over this whole story in detail, but basically, this is from that vaunted FD 1023 form that Republicans were desperate to release to the public last summer, despite the FBI's warnings that the information was not verified, and they were going to hold the FBI director Christopher Wray in contempt of Congress and put him in jail for not releasing it.
Well, I still remember like the early hearings about it too. It was like, we need to release this right away to let the people know about the secret thing. There's things there, I promise. If you just read the report, it's there, I promise. He's a trustworthy guy.
And at the time, Republicans were saying that, and at this time we didn't know who it was.
No.
They were all guessing that it was like the CEO of Burisma or some top executive. No, it's just some shady Russian-affiliated businessman. And he had alleged that he had 17 audio tapes, 15 with Hunter Biden and 2 with Joe Biden, taking bribes in exchange for political favors. That was the story at the time. That is not at all what is in these forms, but according to FBI investigators, they initially deemed his claims, because this was back in 2020 that he filed this form.
Or the FBI filed the form.
Well, it's the form is when they have someone come forward saying they have information,
right,
they generate this form.
And they just write it down, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
And this happened in June of 2020. At the time, the FBI deemed those claims to be uncredible, but due to urging from the Trump DOJ, including Attorney General William Barr, big surprise, the matter was forwarded to Trump-appointed U.S. Attorney for Delaware, David Weiss, who was investigating Hunter Biden for tax and gun charges. Then, Weiss was retained by Joe Biden to avoid any appearance of interference with his investigation into Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son. And David Weiss was the one to charge Alexander Smirnov in this indictment.
What a lib.
Yes, the Trump-appointed attorney. So I have an excerpt from the actual document. We'll link it in the show notes if you want to read the whole thing. I believe it's 37 pages. I read most of it. I lost steam.
I'm proud, yeah.
Somewhere around in the 20s, I kind of gave up.
See, I was too busy reading about the acorn story. That's my problem. I was going too deep into that, like how that mofo actually ended up shooting up that cop car over an acorn.
Mm-hmm. And when you told me the acorn thing, I thought you meant like acorn, a community development group. There was that big story with them and Project Veritas a few years ago. I thought that's what you meant by the acorn story, not a Florida cop who had an acorn land on his police car and thought it was gunfire.
Started, so he dive rolled out of the way and shot up his own car.
Yeah, and started shooting into it.
Which we did not have time for this episode, so we're throwing it
so
in like this.
Let's get back to the story we're talking
about. Yes, yes, yes. The real news, yes.
According to that 37-page indictment, as alleged herein, the events the defendant first reported, so Alexander Smirnov, first reported to the FBI handler in June of 2020 were fabrications. In truth and fact, the defendant had contact with executives from Burisma in 2017, after the end of the Obama-Biden administration and after the then-Ukrainian prosecutor general had been fired in February of 2016. In other words, when public official one, who's Joe Biden, had no ability to influence U.S. policy, and when the prosecutor prosecutor general was no longer in office. So what that means is this is the entire premise of the Republican case to impeach Joe Biden.
Yes.
Is that he took bribes from Burisma so that he would get the prosecutor in Ukraine fired who was investigating Burisma. So that was the quid pro quo.
Which we had like debunked that years ago.
Right. It was exactly the opposite. It was a horribly corrupt prosecutor that was taking money from companies like Burisma in order to not investigate.
I mean, okay, I know it's not insane, but just humor me. Isn't it absolutely insane where that is a demonstrably like verifiable thing?
Right.
And we're still arguing that today.
There was literal international outcry from many nations to get rid of this guy who was just so obviously corrupt. But yeah, this is all part of this plot and it's coming from this guy.
And basically this entire thing where this guy had eyewitness accounts wasn't even actually in it.
Right. So he said that he was in these meetings in 2015 and 2016.
And he had the tapes to prove it.
With these Burisma executives. But that never happened. He was not.
He wasn't even there.
Right. He was in North America. He had never left North America until 2017 when he did have meetings with Burisma, but it was literally just him trying to pitch them his services for buying a U.S. oil or energy company. He was pitching himself as like an expert with IPOs and going public here and that he could help them to buy the company that they wanted to buy so that they could go public with it. And they turned him down. That was the extent of his meetings.
Do we know the motivation behind him just making this up?
It's politically motivated. As the indictment goes on, in short, the defendant transformed his routine and unextraordinary business contacts with Burisma in 2017, later into bribery allegations against Joe Biden, the presumptive nominee of one of the two major political parties for president. They're trying to keep it secret by not saying Joe Biden, but obviously that's who it is.
I mean, we did the same thing with Trump, too, where it's like that, right. That one guy, but you know who that one guy is.
After expressing bias against public official one, aka Joe Biden, and his candidacy. When he was interviewed by FBI agents in September 2023, the defendant repeated some of his false claims, changed his story as to others of his claims, and promoted a new false narrative after he said he met with Russian officials.
Oh, so he's just a Republican. That's all it is.
A standard Republican, yeah. In bed with Putin.
Cool. All right. Well, case closed then. We know now.
Yeah, pretty much. But they're still going to go forward with all of these impeachment inquiries and actually try to vote to impeach Joe Biden based on this.
Cool. I love how our government works. It's great. I'm not red-pilled at all by the whole thing.
Right. So the entire reason why he's being charged, the reason why his story completely falls apart is because he did not have any contact with Burisma, nor did he even leave North America during the time that this could have ever happened, during the time that Joe Biden was vice president and that Hunter Biden was working with Burisma and before the prosecutor got fired in Ukraine. So after all of that happened, Joe Biden's no longer vice president. He cannot set U.S. policy anymore or influence anyone. And the prosecutor's already been removed. What basis is there for Burisma to bribe Joe Biden?
Because they knew.
So clearly this guy is lying.
That's a deep state conspiracy.
They knew he would be president again in 2020. Yeah. So that's where we're at with this story. It's just completely made up by someone who's politically motivated and possibly influenced by Russia, which is exactly what we said in episode 93.
And speaking of impeachments, the House of Representatives has officially impeached Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas after a second attempt and a one-vote victory.
Yep. Steve Scalise returned from his cancer treatment, giving Republicans that single-vote majority that they needed.
Two articles of impeachment accusing Mayorkas of, quote, willful and systemic refusal to comply with the law and a breach of public trust, two very high crimes and misdemeanors. Do they explain how? No. Do they explain why? No. No one cares. It's partisanship, baby.
Now, in order for this to proceed, it must carry a two-thirds majority vote in the Senate to remove Mayorkas, which will not happen.
Now, Senate Dems have joked and said it was already dead on arrival.
Senate Republicans don't support this.
No, they don't.
So, yeah, no chance. A trial may or may not begin.
Hey, Mike Gallagher didn't support it again. Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Proud.
Yeah, the same three that, and you can look at, listen to our last episode, is the same three Republicans that really voted against it last time.
Well, I will say, actually, it is important to note that Gallagher has since announced that he will not be running for re-election as well, which is why he also felt empowered enough to stand against all this
just
nonsense.
Like, yeah, all of the House Republicans that voted to impeach Trump.
Well, and again, it just shows how much of a cult this actually is, because when you have something to lose, you are going to go along with the cult narrative. And it's only when the Republicans are leaving or have already left the cult is when they start speaking against it.
Well, and as we said last time, Gallagher was a young star in the Republican Party.
He was.
And now he's going to be gone. And it's the same thing that happened to Paul Ryan.
Yep.
Once you go against the Trump side of the party, that's it. You do not have a place anymore in Republican politics.
So good job, House Republicans. You did it. You did the thing.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see if they actually do start a trial in the Senate when they return on the 26th.
I don't know. I heard Senate Dems were going to also try to find a way to like motion to dismiss it as well to make even less time.
Yeah, it's very unclear whether or not they have to, looking at the Constitution. This hasn't been done in 150 years. So it's very unclear if the Senate has to start a trial or if they can just not vote on the...
So how many times do we have to say that something's unprecedented in our government and our country's history now to be like, that word doesn't mean anything anymore? It's just how things go now.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens later on this month. And sticking with the House of Representatives,
segues are on point.
We had a special election for New York's 3rd District. The House seat vacated by George Santos, first Latino gay man on the moon. He was replaced by Democrat Tom Suozzi, who defeated Republican Mazie Pillup. It was a 54-46 victory, larger than expected.
Yeah, most polls saw it within like 2 to 6 points.
Mm-hmm. This is mostly in Long Island, kind of a more wealthy district.
And before you begin celebrating,
yeah,
there's limited predictability with this.
Well, and also Suozzi is very conservative.
Well, that's one of those factors. Yeah. So number one, Suozzi actually held the seat prior. He had way more name recognition than Pillup did.
Yeah, he tried to run for governor and lost.
Right.
That's how the seat got vacated by him in the first place.
Correct. He ran hard on Israel, and he also ran hard on the border.
Mm-hmm.
And now everyone is up in arms about how...
That Mexican border of New York.
And now everyone's up in arms about how Democrats should be campaigning because this guy won his special election that he already had way more name recognition over in a special election turnout, which now we've seen that Democrats have consistently more reliable voters in off elections.
And there was bad weather. There was like 4 inches of snow that day.
Right. So here's the thing, Jason. I will say this. It's definitely not bad news for Democrats. Let's put it this way. If Republicans won this seat, even after George Santos lost,
right, after George Santos,
we knew we were in big trouble. Mm-hmm. I honestly would believe that. But, and I'd even say we're probably in big trouble even if it was like a 1 to 2 point election. And there's still debate about whether or not special elections are super predictive. Generally, they can be pretty predictive about what's going on, but still, you got to take into certain facts. I will say the fact that it's a nearly 10-point victory for Suozzi shows that we're actually kind of doing okay as Democrats. We have a lot more work to do before the fall election.
It does narrow the GOP majority in the House to only two votes.
That's it.
Yep, with two still up for grab once Suozzi is sworn in.
Get ready for more chaos. And they're already, I think they're on President's Day break or something like that, or they're going to be on President's Day break sometime soon. And
yeah, they're on break. They come back at the end, at the 26th.
And I think after they come back, they're going to have like what? Like, I think it's like 5 days, 6 days to fund the government again with a 2-vote margin. Are you serious?
Yeah.
My God. Next up, the well-anticipated Hur report. Looking into Joe Biden's illegal and unethical handling of classified documents, found that Joe Biden is old.
Didn't really need a special counsel for that.
The report concluded that charges were not warranted and that no illegal activity was found at the end of the day. quote from the report, Mr. Biden's memory was significantly limited both during his recorded interviews with the ghostwriter in 2017 and in his interview with our office in 2023, and his cooperation with our investigation, including by reporting to the government that the Afghanistan documents were in his Delaware garage, will likely convince some jurors that he made an innocent mistake, rather than acting willfully, that is, with the intent to break the law, as the statute requires. So he's just a
doddering old
man, made some mistakes.
And this is a very, like, there's a lot of opinion put in this for an official government report.
Yes, I agree. Okay, it's tough for me because I listen to a lot of Democratic and liberal podcasters and influencers, and obviously everyone is going gangbusters on the fact, this is a partisan report. The guy is a partisan hack who way overstepped his boundaries. He didn't need to say anything about this. Sure, okay, but this is what it is. It happens, and I'm not going to sit here and try to like dismiss an entire report over a couple of lines. I'm sorry. And I think the fact that Democrats are trying to just embrace the fact that the report says he's old and he has some bad memory is the completely wrong strategy here, where you should just keep showing over and over again, he did nothing illegal. Why are we saying anything about this? It was found that he did nothing wrong. I don't know. Am I crazy?
Well, this was always what was presented, right? That yes, Joe Biden had classified documents that he didn't know he had. And when he found them, he contacted the proper authorities and returned them.
Well, thank you. Okay. So that's a good segue, because I have another excerpt from the report that compares Biden and Trump. Remember, this is from the partisan hack who is a Republican. It is not our role to assess the criminal charges pending against Mr. Trump, but several material distinctions between Mr. Trump's case and Mr. Biden's case are clear. Unlike the evidence involving Mr. Biden, the allegations set forth in the indictment of Mr. Trump, if proven, would present serious aggravating facts. Most notably, after being given multiple chances to return classified documents and avoid prosecution, Mr. Trump allegedly did the opposite. According to the indictment, he not only refused to return the documents for many months, but he also obstructed justice by enlisting others to destroy evidence and then to lie about it. In contrast, Mr. Biden turned in classified documents to the National Archives and the Department of Justice, consented to the search of multiple locations, including his homes, sat for a voluntary interview, and in other ways cooperated with the investigation. Let's be real here. I don't give a rip if Joe Biden is old. Yes, the report does call him an elderly, well-meaning man. Yes, he does. The report
with
does say
he has a significantly limited memory.
Right. It's not great. I'm okay with that. It's not great. It is what it is. But can we please share the comparison to Donald Trump, for God's sakes? Why are we so embracing the fact that he's old? Donald Trump is also old, and he's a criminal who obstructs justice.
Not so well-meaning.
And of course, Biden did the smart thing and goes out of his way and talks to reporters to make things way worse.
In his description, you are a well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory.
I'm well-meaning and I'm an elderly man and I know what the hell I'm doing. I've been president and I put this country back on its feet. I don't need his recommendation. It's
how
totally
bad is your memory, and can you continue as president?
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
And they have expressed concerns about your age.
That is your judgment. That is your judgment. That is not the judgment of the press.
They expressed concerns about your mental acuity. They say that you are too old. Mr. President, in December, you told me that you believe there are many other Democrats who could defeat Donald Trump. So why does it have to be you now? What is your answer to that question?
Because I'm the most qualified person in this country to be president of the United States and finish the job I started.
So cool.
I mean, the answer at the end wasn't terrible. That's what he should say. I don't believe him.
But even then, he sounds ornery as hell.
That's fine. It's the, like, my memory's so bad I let you speak. What the hell does that mean?
Well, I will say, for reference, that is Peter Ducey asking that.
Right. Well, had he said,
and
like,
my guess is that he's like, hey, I forgot that you're already a dick and I shouldn't have let you
he
speak
should say, me. Your name's Peter Ducey. You're a Nepo baby who works for Fox News because so does your daddy.
Right.
And that would have been much better.
I agree. So it's not looking great. And again, partisan bias or not in the report, it worked. Because now everyone's talking about Biden's age, which is driving me freaking nuts. He's old. I get it. I understand he's freaking old. Stop focusing on his stupid freaking age. Vote for Grandpa Joe.
Back home here to Wisconsin for yet another Wisconsin maps update. Surprisingly, this week, the Wisconsin legislature passed a redistricting map proposed proposed by Governor Evers in 2021. This is basically their final attempt to avoid having the state Supreme Court choose the maps instead. Odd that Republicans literally sued the state to not use these maps when they were first proposed, even though the, at that time, conservative majority state Supreme Court ruled that those were the maps that would be used. Instead, the Republican legislature and the Republican Party sued, bringing the matter to the United States Supreme Court, which for some reason got involved in state-run elections, overturned that decision, and we kept the existing incredibly gerrymandered, terrible maps that were drawn by the conservative legislature in 2011. And Republicans at that time called, again, these same maps that they now want to use, rigged and drawn in secret without public input, which now they adopted without holding any public hearings on their bill.
And without pretty much any Democratic support.
Yeah, they only had one Democrat vote for the maps in both the Senate and Assembly.
So let's talk about why they're doing this. Long story short, Assembly and Senate Republicans are trying to put the governor in a tough place or a tough spot. When he vetoed the maps last time, I believe it was like a bill that had some amendments that tried to basically redraw it so a bunch of Republican incumbents could stay in their districts.
Mm-hmm.
He vetoed those, saying that he will only sign his own maps unchanged. Anything that's changed are considered not his maps, and he will not sign them. So they have this idea that, number one, they're afraid that the Supreme Court, or the state Supreme Court, is going to choose some kind of map that's worse for Republicans than the governor's map.
Right. The governor originally drew these maps with the directive that they needed to be least amount of change.
Yeah.
So they are not partisan or gerrymandered in any way, shape, or form. They still are somewhat Republican favored. Not nearly as much as they are now.
Yes, it has a 3-point statewide Republican lean, which, to be honest, sounds pretty accurate in my book, which when I looked at the data. The other thing we need to think about, too, is Robin Voss is currently the Mitch McConnell and the Speaker of Wisconsin's Assembly is currently facing a recall right now.
By the right. Because he didn't try to overturn the election in Wisconsin.
That is correct. And if that recall is successful, he will face a special election before the fall general. One of the amendments they have is about implementation so that a recall election would not be influenced by the new maps. And Robin Voss specifically wants that in there because in the new maps drawn by the governor, Robin Voss is drawn out of his district. And finally, number three, I don't really understand it myself, but there's been a lot of legal talk about it. You kind of hinted at it as well as trying to get the federal courts involved in this by passing it if the governor signs it. Basically, the idea would be if the governor signs it, the Republicans are going to try to challenge the constitutionality of those maps.
Their whole thing is to just delay it past the
2024
right.
election. And that's the idea, is that they knew that it would still lose, but they would hope that the federal courts would enact a stay on the maps, making the current maps the ones we would use for 2024, giving them just a little bit more power for a little bit longer time. It's tough, man. I get it.
I hope he vetoes them.
I'm going to be 100% honest with you. Yes, I agree with you. I personally believe that no one other than people like you and I, Jason, follow the maps battle in Wisconsin because we are weirdos, right? We talked about this before. We are weirdos who follow politics. If I talk to anyone else, if I ask my mom about what's going on with the maps, she would have no clue about what's going on right now.
Well, our listeners, now you all know too.
There you go.
And I say let the state Supreme Court.
I 100% agree.
Pick the map.
Don't, my advice to Tony Evers, don't get caught in this, like, I'm going to try to save face things. Yes, I know you said you were going to sign your maps a week ago. Just give them whatever reason you want to give. You can make it up. I don't even care at this
they
point.
They do have an out because there was language changed in when they would take effect.
Yes, exactly.
And that's what the theory is with Robin Voss, is because if you just pass exactly what Tony Evers had at that time, those maps would take effect now.
Yes.
Whereas if they pass it the way they have it written, they would take effect in November. So then Robin Voss gets to go through his special election still in his district.
Correct. So just take it on the chin. You're going to have some bad press for a week, and then no one's going to remember.
Mm-hmm.
No one's going to care, especially since you aren't up for election until 2026.
Yeah. And Tony Evers does have until Tuesday of next week to either sign or veto the bill. So we'll know soon enough.
And And the only indication that his office has given is that your spokesperson for the office said that they stand by what they said before, which was they will only sign Governor Evers' map. They did not indicate anything else besides that.
Yeah, unchanged.
Yeah, so we'll see.
M&M's will not be satisfied until every last cartoon character is deeply unappealing and totally androgynous, until the moment you wouldn't want to have a drink with any one of them. That's the goal. When you're totally turned off, they've won.
Boy, ain't right.
This week on Fox in the Head, Tay-Tay wins.
The rigged NFL.
Did you see Joe Biden's tweet?
Yes, yes. Everything is going to plan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good job, Joe.
That was a good one, whoever they had working on that one.
It was a good script.
Yeah, good.
It had me excited at the end.
Mm-hmm. I was not pleased with the outcome, but it was a good game.
I was rooting for the 49ers, but it wasn't a bad Super Bowl, let's put it this way. I got to see SpongeBob.
I wanted to see Travis Kelce fight.
Did you? Okay, I know it's a meme now, but did you actually like see the clip of how he yelled at Andy Reid?
Mm-hmm.
And just, it didn't even like
almost knocked him down.
Yeah, yeah, like it didn't even like really like yell, like if they're trying to get into a fight, it just scared the shit out of Andy Reid. Like, oh my God.
Yeah, he didn't know he was even there. It was very clearly.
And also he's going, oh, Jesus Christ. Yeah, you're Travis.
It's just being passionate.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was one of my other favorites.
Obviously, if he was a black player, then he was a thug.
Yep. That was exactly what I was going to say, too. That's one of my favorite hot takes about the whole thing. It's like, well, if Travis was black, you want to bet what the response was going to be?
Yep. Get that thug out of there. There's no place in the NFL.
But the thing that conservatives were mad about the most, surprisingly, wasn't the halftime show for once.
Right.
Surprisingly wasn't about the national anthem or for some reason Post Malone singing God Bless America.
He's a country star now?
I don't know what.
Yeah.
It's the, and you may remember this from previous episode, the famous He Gets Us ads, because they're too woke for Jesus.
Jesus loves feet. That's Jesus, what I learned. He is a foot freak.
Jesus washed feet.
Jesus took pictures of your feet and posted them to WikiFeet.
So for those who haven't seen the ad, it's kind of similar to the other ones that we talked about like a year ago, where basically it's a bunch of still images of people who are supposed to be diametrically opposed, and one of them is washing the feet like of someone else.
Whites and blacks.
Well, that's the crazy thing, right?
It's always like super racism
right,
in this ad.
Because you know this is like a super conservative, like religious group. These are Hobby Lobby people, right? Who are doing this thing.
Whites and minorities can't get along.
And all I could think about the entire time is you have the white person, and we'll get to this in the clips, but you have the white person who's usually the conservative Christian who's trying to show grace and wash the feet of someone they don't like. So what they're doing is like literally showing all of us the people they don't like. And literally, like you said, Jason, it's people of color, Muslims, women who go to abortion clinics. Yes,
LGBT. Yeah.
So, of course, conservatives are super angry about this. And no one besides Matt Walsh would miss the point as hard.
Yeah, Matt Walsh, the only fetish he will stand for is baby fetish. No foot fetish stuff around Matt.
So let's hear why Matt Walsh is upset about the He Gets Us ad.
We can already determine that the ad is, at best, a wasted opportunity. The most generous thing I could possibly say about a message like Jesus didn't teach hate is that it's redundant and pointless and benign. And that is, again, in its best form. Because everybody already knows that Jesus didn't teach hate, okay? We know that. It's the only thing that most people these days know about Jesus. The fact that Jesus didn't go around telling his followers to hate people is an extremely well-established fact. Again, it's like the only well-established fact these days. So nobody was ever confused about it. We know that Jesus didn't hate people. We know that hating people is bad. Nobody believes in or promotes hate for its own sake. Even hateful people don't see themselves that way.
Oh, really, Matt Walsh? No one hates people and promotes hate for hate's sake.
The man who promotes LGBT hate.
Constantly.
Every day on his show.
The man who promotes racist hate on his show. Constantly. Man, and just whiff right over his head. I'm baffled by the lack of awareness this guy possesses. What makes it even dumber is that he contradicts himself in the next statement.
You know, it's not actually true that hate is always bad. There are things we're supposed to hate. We're supposed to hate sin, just as Jesus did. hate should be directed at bad things. We should hate bad things, and we should love good things. This also may seem obvious, but it's a distinction that many people in our world often miss, which is just another reason why putting out a broad anti-hate ad that offers no further insight into the issue is useless. And if it's not useless, then it's actively harmful.
I agree, Matt Walsh. Religion is useless.
And if it's not useless, it's actively harmful.
That is the great description of religion.
I can't get over the fact that right here he said, well, it's so clear. Like, that's like the only thing Jesus taught was not to hate people. Everyone knows that. But let's be real here.
But it's not exactly true. Yeah.
You're the one who just said it. You just freaking said it, dude. Ah! And then finally, he gets into the actual images that we just talked about and says that it's all actually just racist against people like him.
Which brings us to the images on the screen. So who are the people getting their feet washed? Well, we see a few sort of non-specific generic feet washing scenarios, if that can even exist. And then we see a white man washing the feet of a Native American. We see another white man washing the feet of a climate protester. We see a white woman washing the feet of, I guess, her Muslim neighbor. We see a white woman washing the feet of an illegal immigrant. We see a cop washing the feet of a black guy in a back alley. Kind of strange. I don't know what's going on there. We see a priest washing the feet of a gay black guy on the beach. And then we see a woman outside of an abortion clinic getting her feet washed by what appears to be a pro-life protester. Now, you'll notice that, unsurprisingly, the ad is very careful to make sure that it doesn't depict a white person getting his feet washed by a non-white person. So we see every combination of feet washing going on, except for that one. Apparently, Jesus calls us to wash feet unless you're black and the other person is white, because that would be racist. And this already tells you everything you need to know about the campaign and the people funding it. The ad strictly follows and respects the left-wing victim hierarchy, and dutifully make sure to not depict any image that would run afoul of the rules of intersectionality. If they had reversed the roles in any of these scenarios, then the ad would have been, to at least some small degree, culturally subversive. Okay, what if it was a black guy washing the feet of the cop?
Yes, Jason, what if a black guy would wash the feet of a cop? What would that tell us about Jesus?
Nothing that we didn't already know.
I mean, again, the idea, look, I already don't like that he gets this ad.
Well, I mean, you said it right at the beginning, right? This is because the people that created this ad see themselves as the Jesus figure.
Yep.
In this. So they're the person washing the feet, and I'm sorry, they're all white people.
Yep.
So they put themselves as the gracious, forgiving, like, messiah figure. So that's why they're washing the feet of all of the groups that they hate.
And what's even funnier is that I didn't include the clip for this one. He also goes on after that to basically arguing exactly that, which is like, well, the reason why Jesus washed the feet of his disciples was because it was people that he cared about. It's not like he owed them a good foot washing. You know, I'm not going to just like demand and bend a knee to you and wash your feet because it's just what you want. I'm like, what are you talking about? Oh, man. Like, and he just goes on.
Look, okay, I don't mean to try to teach Jesus to everyone here.
Oh, I am.
But the whole thing, the point of that story is these were all people that were cast out from society. Like, yes. Mary Magdalene, she's a whore, she's unclean. And Jesus, to show his humility to these people that even the lowest in society have,
who don't deserve respect.
Well, they are still worthy in his eyes, that he puts everyone above himself. That's why he washes
their feet.
It's just that simple. It's kind of a dumb cliche. It's something that you know, get taught when you're a little kid. And that's it. I don't care, really. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what Matt Walsh is even arguing here, because he's all over the place. It's just, he's just upset. That's all I get out of this.
It's just identity politics at the end of the day for him. He just doesn't like the fact that he feels persecuted because he's white. That's all it is at the end of the day. All right, let's be real here.
Everything is a racist attack against
white people.
Yeah.
That's all it is. And let's answer his question here. Why didn't they have a black person washing the feet of the cop? It's because it's exactly what you just said. There's a societal dynamic at play where we have seen over and over again, where, and we're going to see it again later in this episode, that the police demonize, villainize, and literally beat and kill black people systemically. There is a power dynamic throughout our country's history. That is why it would make no sense to have a black person washing the feet of a white cop.
And in that scenario, that makes the black person Jesus, which, you know, they're not going to want anyway. So.
Oh, he's so stupid.
Yes. So what I wanted to talk about from all the Super Bowl craziness were the conspiracies that were being thrown out about Taylor Swift's guest.
Oh.
Ice Spice.
What were the conspiracies about Ice Spice?
And I wonder why everyone that was freaking out up to the Super Bowl about Taylor Swift and how she's a psyop, all this stuff, all of a sudden, once the cameras were there and you had a black woman to choose from as your target, all of a sudden everyone started focusing on her instead. I have just a couple, it's going to be real short, but I just have a couple tweets and social media posts from random conservatives here. The first one is going to be from Evan Kilgore, who I have no idea who he is. According to his bio, he's a political commentary. I don't know if he means commentator. Christian, conservative, American nationalist, Trump 2024. So your pretty standard boilerplate white conservative. He says, nothing to see here. Taylor Swift being an alcoholic while Ice Spice throws up some demonic and satanic hand gestures.
What did I miss?
These people worship and work for the devil. Wake up.
What did I miss? I don't remember any of this.
The Twitter account End Wokeness, which I have seen before, says, demonic hand gestures on the big screen. Upside down cross. Balenciaga sleeve. Not even hiding it. I don't know what Balenciaga has to do with the devil, but
I don't either.
A lot of people seem to think that there's a connection there.
Is there?
There was more than one person that posted that. Did you notice what brand she was wearing? So, yeah.
I'm going to look up while you're doing the next one.
Another tweet from JD Sharp, who their pinned tweet is, Joe Biden did not win the 2020 presidential election and received nowhere near 81 million legitimate votes. I had to say, reality is she was literally summoning demons in front of 200 million people last night. And then Stop the Steal organizer and literal groomer and pedophile Ali Alexander, who, this is not a tweet. I don't know what right-wing social media this came from. We got it from Media Matters. But Ali Alexander has actually been banned from even Elon Musk's Twitter after the grooming allegations came out. He had to say, watched a couple minutes of the Super Bowl. Ha ha ha. Oh, he's so funny.
Oh, you did it.
Totally fake and rigged. Might as well be flag football. Notice no grass stains. And that's one I saw multiple times too. People saying that the whole game was fake because there was no grass stains on anyone's uniform.
Shut up. No. 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 No.
Like, we all watched it. We physically watched it. There were people at the game. We know where it was. Like, what in the world? Does he think it's all like a simulation? I don't understand. Like, you can say it's scripted. That's dumb.
Okay.
Impossible to choreograph, but fine. But to say it's fake.
I will say injuries originate at the sidelines. Man, the 49ers. They had a rough night.
There's non-contact injuries all the time.
Yeah, that was a rough one. I will say that.
And those are usually the bad ones.
Also, apparently Balenciaga had some ads where I guess they're accused on TikTok of hiding secret satanic messages. So there you go.
So Balenciaga is the devil.
Yeah. So just wearing Balenciaga means that you're... But again, this is the same crap where it's like... Remember with the Target moral panic stuff where it was like by a company or a designer who happened to design stuff that also happened to design some random like cutesy Satan crap? And it's like, well, if you wear anything by that designer, you are a Satanist. I'm like, well, no, that's not how association works. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. It's a brand, you guys. Jesus.
And then you had former Fox News producer Kyle Becker also saying that Ice Spice was summoning demons.
What?
And apparently, so the whole thing, like, everyone was like, she was wearing an upside down cross. I was raised Catholic. She apparently is Catholic. There is St. Peter's, very big. Like, he was supposed to be the rock of the Catholic Church. That Jesus built his church on the rock of St. Peter.
Yeah.
St. Peter, in Catholic lore, was crucified upside down.
So he's the devil.
So her upside down cross to Catholics is known as a St. Peter's cross and is not some kind of demonic symbol. I'm sorry.
Well, again, can I just...
And she threw up the devil horns sure. while dancing to a song at one point. So that's when she was summoning demons. Ooh. And so does everyone at every rock concert I've ever been to.
Well, and can I
demons
just,
everywhere. Yeah,
can I just back the hell up for a little bit and just say, hey, these are adults who think demons are real.
Right.
And that they can be, summoned, at a football game.
With a hand gesture.
At a football game. They're just on call, you know, that's the thing. If you just wear your Balenciaga and you get that special, that's why the suites cost so much. You get devil, demon access.
Right. So demon that was service. My favorite part of the Super Bowl was the conservative Christian freak out because there was a black woman wearing a very, very expensive cross around her neck because she's Catholic. So apparently she's demonic and summoning demons.
Cool. This is great. I love this country.
Yep.
Hashtag Tay-Tay for life. Swifty for life.
That was really a productive segment, wasn't it? It's hard to get any word in with this clown.
This week, we're going to take a look at Mississippi in the early 1960s and how student activists faced resentment and violence while attempting to register black voters across the state. This is the story of Freedom Summer in 1964, but we're going to have a little bit of background before we do that. You see, back in the 1960s, Mississippi had the lowest registration rate of black voters in the country. In Mississippi, 6.7% of black residents were registered to vote. That's compared to between 50 and 60% in other states throughout the entire country.
So almost one-tenth of
right.
the average.
Exactly. Obviously, much of this was intentional. Black voters would have made up around half of the electorate in many southern states, Mississippi included. But of course, many white people felt terrified that allowing black people to vote would lead to a great replacement, if you will. It's also worth noting during this time, the KKK was actually not well established in Mississippi. They had their own thing called the Citizens Council that did all the work the KKK would actually be doing, but out in the open. And of course, with established government and business officials all pushing for a white supremacist society.
And the Citizens Council was actually born out of a reaction to the Brown versus Board of Education ruling.
In the 1950s, right?
Yeah, 1957, I believe, that said that segregation was unconstitutional. The Citizens Council opposed any effort towards integration and used Red Scare tactics to paint civil rights as communism.
Where have we heard that before?
Much like we have now, where any social program is labeled communism. The council spread its message through mass mailings, speeches, a widely heard radio program, and even a weekly television broadcast, the Citizens Council Forum, which was paid for with state funds.
Woo!
You know, actual communism.
And this is when Bob Moses enters the picture. In 1961, Bob Moses, a high school teacher and activist from New York, moved to Jackson, Mississippi to begin organizing young black residents. He later joined the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or the SNCC staff, and became the voter registration director of Mississippi's Council of Federated Organizations. Keep in mind, this was not a big group at all. By the end of Moses' second year of recruiting efforts, there were approximately 20 to 25 SNCC organizers in the entire state. These organizers were guided by the philosophy that, according to Moses in a speech, said the world is upset and they feel if they're ever going to get it straight, they must upset it more. Those organizers went door to door in black neighborhoods trying to persuade people to register to vote, but they had little luck at first. Most black residents were terrified of trying to register to vote. Tests were given by county registrars for black residents to interpret specific passages of the state and U.S. constitutions and were usually thrown out for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, they had literacy tests in order to vote.
Right. We'll put resources in the notes as well. There's a lot of good stories about how you had black people with PhDs who could not understand these
right.
tests.
It's a civics test.
Right.
It's not something that any average person would be able to pass.
Correct.
And it was written that way.
On purpose.
Obviously, yeah.
Elected officials and people of power would come in while residents were filling out this registration stuff, threatening them to have them fired for their jobs if they ever submitted the paperwork. So Some counties set up systems to have names of those who recently registered to vote appear in the newspaper, putting targets on people's backs, further scaring them more. And of course, in retaliation for movements trying to register people to vote, state and local governments cut funding for food programs to rural and impoverished areas, essentially trying to starve out Black communities for trying to vote. And that's when people began paying attention. During the potential starve out, I guess you could say, Dick Gregory, a famous Black comedian at the time, flew into Mississippi delivering thousands of pounds of food to residents. And this caught the eye of national media, which started paying attention to what was actually happening in Mississippi at that time. And this is where Bob Moses proposed the idea for Freedom Summer. Moses wanted everyone to keep attention on Mississippi, so he proposed inviting concerned white students from across the nation to volunteer and help register Black voters in the state. This was actually a controversial decision among many early organizers who thought bringing outsiders in would hurt the project, especially since a lot of them were all white and would not understand the ordeals that Black residents had to go through. And even though there was a lot of debate about it, proponents eventually won out and Freedom Summer began. Recruitment for volunteers started and nearly 1,000 students, mostly white, came down to Mississippi to volunteer. And there were three objectives for the project. Number one, knock on doors to as many people as you can and ask residents to go out and vote. Number two, establish freedom schools in Black communities, which would help teach Black students math, reading, and specifically Black history that was not allowed to be taught in state-sanctioned Black schools. It would also give Black children access to libraries they've never had access to before, since libraries were also segregated. One resident had a story that I really liked that said, one resident who was a child during this time said he never even heard of Dr. Seuss or Cat in the Hat until he had the chance to read it at a freedom school. And then finally, number three, establish the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party that would run parallel to the Mississippi Democratic Party and challenge the all-white delegates at the convention.
And that's probably always the most important thing you can do is gain political power.
Yes. And I don't know, man. When I hear a lot about these types of stories, I think the focus is too far away from people had to, because we always talk about how people had to overcome adversity, right? We hear about all the March for Civil Rights and things like that, but we forget the fact that, or we're not told the fact that all of this is done because white people are terrified of giving up power and they're terrified of losing their power to groups of people they don't like or respect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that usually gets lost in a lot of civil rights storytelling, at least in my opinion. I don't know if you had different experiences.
That's the main motivation. No, you don't hear that usually. You don't hear it told from that perspective. They usually don't give any agency to the racists. They're others. They're just purely evil for evil's sake.
Yeah.
They're not trying to protect their own power in a system. They just hate everyone.
Which I also think is why it's very easy to separate or isolate that period of time compared to now, where we don't think that we're bad or racist today because we're not just evil and racist for racist sake. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we'll get back to the story. Elected officials in Mississippi responded to the movement pretty much exactly how you'd expect. They increased police forces. They passed new ordinances against demonstrations. Even Jackson's government purchased a brand new riot control vehicle known as Thompson's Tank after Jackson Mayor Alan Thompson.
And this was, I looked it up, this is the same vehicle that transported James Earl Ray after he was caught for the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. So it does have a very historical significance.
By 1964, the KKK rose to popularity in the state in response to the Summer Freedom Project.
It was a new group known as the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan in Mississippi. We have a quote from Imperial Wizard, very serious adults.
I was just going to say that.
Sam Bowers, who stated that they were an army that would resist the N-word communist invasion of Mississippi. As we said before, straight from the council, any civil rights is communism.
And I think it's, I know we just said it before, but I think it's really important just to stop and pause and say, again, the playbook by Republicans and conservatives, and even, we'll say, the enlightened centrist today that talk about wokeness all day long, use the exact same playbook that racists used to stop civil rights movements in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
There is a direct through line between those anti-civil rights movements and today. But even in the face of the KKK emerging, the project moved forward. Tragedy first struck the organization when three of their activists, one Black and two white, went missing, only to have authorities find their car destroyed days later. Bob Moses had to tell the predominantly white class of volunteers that that their lives could not be guaranteed throughout the summer. And things didn't get easier either. Throughout the summer, 65 buildings, including 35 churches, were bombed or burned. Over 1,000 arrests were made throughout the movement, and over 100 volunteers reported being physically assaulted. Later, the bodies of those three missing activists were found buried in the woods.
And this is a well-known story. The three activists were Mickey Schwerner, James Chaney, and Andrew Goodman. They were detained under false speeding charges by Neshoba County's deputy, Cecil Price, who was actively working with Klan members, and held them until Klan members could be mobilized. Once released and told to leave town, they were followed by two cars of Klansmen and Deputy Price. A chase ensued, and they were eventually caught and brutally murdered. There is a 1988 film titled Mississippi Burning, starring Gene Hackman, Frances McDormand, and Willem Dafoe, about the FBI investigation into those murders.
And although approximately 17,000 black residents of Mississippi attempted to register to vote thanks to the Freedom Summer Project in 1964, only 1,600 of the completed applications were accepted by local registrars.
So less than 10%.
So we have one of the largest voting drives in the country at that time. I mean, the idea of trying to mobilize 17,000 people in the 1960s is an insane number.
Right.
Especially in the South.
Right. So 17,000 people trying to exercise their right to vote, and somehow only 1,600 of them were actually allowed to do so.
Correct.
So that is disenfranchised.
And because of this, more and more people began calling for national voting legislation and protection,
which are today under attack by the Republican Party.
Correct. But we're going to focus on the other party this time.
Right. When,
because did you know, Jason, that actually back in the day, the Democrats were the racists?
Yeah, it's for about one more year after this.
But the news of the missing activists ignited a new passion for the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. While many residents were afraid to register to vote, registering for the party was safer and much more confidential. Delegates held their first state convention in 1964 and took buses to Atlantic City to make their case to the national convention, something that President Lyndon Johnson was not happy about. Because you see,
Democrat Lyndon Johnson.
Yeah. Super lib, woke Lyndon Johnson did not want the convention to choose the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party's delegates out of fear it would lose him white votes in the South. During the convention, representatives made speeches to the convention pleading their case on live TV. Even Martin Luther King Jr. spoke in defense. However, President Johnson held a spontaneous press conference during the exact time one of their delegates, Fannie Lou Hamer, was speaking to announce the 9-month anniversary of Gov Conley being shot.
Which was how Johnson became president, because that was during the Kennedy assassination that Conley was shot.
And if you think it's kind of weird that he would held a surprise press conference to announce the 9-month anniversary of Connally being shot, yeah, it's because it was weird and actually deliberate, because Johnson specifically did not want Fannie Lou Hamer to be seen speaking. However, it backfired because it became a news story that he covered up Hamer's speech, and stations nationwide started broadcasting Hamer's testimony. Her testimony convinced many of the delegates, but President Johnson did everything in his power to stop this. He even threatened Hubert Humphrey's VP status until he, quote, fixed the Mississippi problem. Ultimately, a compromise was given to the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party delegation, where they would be given 2 seats of delegates and let the all-white Dem Party, who they already convinced everybody was unethically suppressing black votes, to keep the rest of the delegates. The Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party ultimately rejected the offer on principle. And while the movement suffered a huge loss on the national stage, they were one of the pivotal pressures which pushed President Johnson to sign the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And by the end of 1965, over 60% of black residents in Mississippi were registered to vote.
And that is one of the main things that did switch the political parties in America, when you had then the Republicans deciding they wanted to go after all of the racist whites in the South that hated the fact that Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act.
And the reason why I wanted to talk about this story is this is, again, kind of in the same, or it's in lockstep with our episode last week, where it's just another forgotten chapter of our history. And when you think of the civil rights movement, you usually think of like Martin Luther King Jr. You think of the March on Washington. You don't think about Freedom Summer, and you don't think about Mississippi. And I think while last week we had a lot of very depressing stories and very brutal news to talk about, this is a story where you can see see positive change coming out of people's extremely hard work, courage, and dedication. And it's exactly what we would want to strive for as a country today, too. And I'll include a couple of resources about Freedom Summer and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the show notes. I'll also include a link to Freedom Summer, a PBS documentary, which I'm going to admit right now, I'll include the link to it.
I couldn't watch it.
Here's the deal. Here's the hell I went through trying to find this movie. Are you ready? The PBS link I'm going to link to you does not link to the movie. You can stream it, but for some reason they have the trailer
link. Yeah. When I went to try to watch it and it said, watch this documentary, it just played the trailer and that was it.
I don't know if you played it with it, but the transcript is for the full movie. It has the entire transcript of the movie down below.
So you can read the movie.
If you look at other streaming ways, the exact way this movie's set up actually plays the movies. But for some reason, this one is not playable. They must have put the wrong video in or something because it's ridiculous. On top of that, Jason, I couldn't play it on Amazon because it wouldn't allow me to play it there. And then I had to literally get my fiance's library card information to sign up for Canopy to play it via Canopy. But then I couldn't play it via Canopy because Google Chrome wasn't working on Canopy. So I had to use Safari play Canopy to watch this movie. I highly, highly, highly recommend watching this PBS documentary. It is
a win for Tim Apple.
It is incredible about the stories that they tell throughout this movie. We left out so much more information that you can learn about throughout this documentary, and the footage and pictures they have really showcase what this movement was. So I highly encourage it. But to end this episode about it and to end our story about it, I want to end with the final words of Fannie Lou Hamer's speech that moved the entire convention at the DNC.
And just to give some background on Fannie Lou Hamer, she is the daughter of sharecroppers from Mississippi and grew up working on that same plantation. She was given a hysterectomy without her knowledge or consent in 1961, a procedure so common it was known as a Mississippi appendectomy, which is what set her on the path towards civil rights activism. And just to set up the clip that you're about to hear, she is recounting a story when she and several activists were beaten by police and other black inmates who were forced to beat them as well and given weapons by the police after being jailed for protesting segregation by sitting at a bus station's whites-only lunch counter in June of 1963. We will have the link to the full speech in our show notes.
So enjoy the ending of Fannie Lou Hamer's speech to the DNC.
After the first Negro had beat him till he was exhausted, the state highway patrolman ordered the second Negro to take the blackjack. The second Negro began to beat, and I began to work my feet. And the state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro had beat to sit on my feet, to keep me from working my feet. I began to scream, and one white man got up and began to beat me in my head and tell me to hush. One white man, my dress had worked up high. He walked over and pulled my dress. I pulled my dress down, and he pulled my dress back up. I was in jail when Medgar Evers was murdered. All of this is on account of we want to register to become first-class citizens. And if the Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hook because our lives be threatened daily because we want to live as decent human beings in America?